right. We're here on Conspiracy Normal. What's up, Luke?
I'm Mustard. I'm hype.
Yeah, you are hype, man.
Yeah.
You just gave me a little bit of rap skills right before the... before we started recording.
Freestyle beatbox and lay the track down.
Yeah, I might put one of those at the end of the show. You never know.
Awesome.
So what you been doing, man? How you been?
Still...
It's not that I haven't seen you all day, but how you been?
So that our viewers or listeners know, still living in my car. Still a great time. It's freezing here in Tennessee.
Well, you know, hey, there's for any ladies out there in the Conspiracy Normal universe, Luke needs a home.
For any sugar mamas who, so, I'll treat you real good.
You know, like 60-year-old sugar mamas.
I'll treat you real good. I'll rub your feet and everything.
Yeah. He'll be your boy toy. Anyway, great news. Last week or 2 weeks ago, we had the Chris White interview about the Ancient Aliens Debunked film that he did. And that was our most downloaded and most listened to show ever. We've had 300 and something views. I believe 310 views. Plays, downloads on Podomatic, and have now gotten into we're number 74 in religion and spirituality on Podomatic. And I think we've picked up some new listeners. Of course, we might have dropped them after, you know, talking about boy toys and sugar mamas. But
no, not quite. We've had some more some dirtier conversation than that before.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But I also posted... Yes, last night, the lost episode that was recorded six Ooh. Months ago on May 7th, 2012. That was our actual first appearance with Mr. Tom Bionic. Our second appearance, which is actually show number four, was about sleep paralysis. And that was a good show. It was a much better show than the one that came before. Nothing that is Mr. Tom Bionic's fault, but we were all a little bit off that night. And I was sick. I had a headache all day. Luke, you were
inebriated,
which was interesting. Made for an interesting time. And listening to it back, it appears that your mic just wasn't working at all.
Right.
Just completely not even working.
Thanks, Chris.
I think this mic that we're using now, which is the only mic we use now, by the way, was actually the one that I had, and it was picking Luke up. So if anyone listens to that show, that's episode 16, if you're listening to Luke, it sounds like he's talking to us from a great...
From a steel can.
Yeah, from a steel can. And Chris himself was, believe had just hurt his back and was on painkillers at the time. And every time the computer would go to screensaver, he would stop to get the screensaver back on. He would press the space bar, which would stop Audacity. So there are two times you will hear it just stop, and then all of a sudden we'll come back.
Moving onward.
Yeah. So I just kept all that in there. And there's some good information in the show, but, it's not one that we're exceptionally proud of. But I think we've gotten a little better with it since. And Chris is not here because he's going down to Alabama for... Thanksgiving break.
Alabama man.
So what did you think about Chris White in the interview that we did last time?
I gotta remember it. It's a couple weeks ago, man. It's reaching back.
Man, I spring that on you all the time. Just spring that stuff on you.
Refresh my memory with some
Ancient Aliens Debunked.
Yeah, we already did a review of them at the end of that show, but...
Yeah.
I got to watch a little bit of his documentary.
You did?
Okay. Yeah, it was an hour and a half, about 2 hours long.
It's about 3 hours and 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
It's long.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it, though, and, he's, like I said before, he's definitely done his research. He's a really smart guy, and appreciate that he is out there searching, you know, to dig things up rather than just hearsay all the time. Everyone you talk to, always hearsay, you know, I heard this or I watched this, and never show you the solid evidence and proof, and he seems to have collected a lot of that, so that's pretty good.
One of the things I liked about the show was, you know, you asked him some things that he actually kind of had to look up while he was, while we were talking. And I thought that was good because it showed that he's willing to look into things, even while in the midst of an interview.
Yeah.
You know, he's willing to look
into
it.
I mean, that's the way this should be anyway, you know?
Right.
The whole, you know, our show, that's kind of how it is. Because we look up stuff sometimes, too, the Wraith Chasers and all that, so.
Yeah. But we want to welcome, you know, any of our new listeners that are out there. You know, I noticed that we got people in Hungary downloading our show, people in Sweden, Norway, the home of Luke's favorite genre of music, which is black metal.
Actually, death metal.
Oh, well.
But close enough. Eastern Europe.
Well, you know, I'm ignorant of the whole metal thing.
Or actually Western Europe, yeah.
Yeah, Northern Europe, Scandinavia.
Northern Europe.
We got Romania, lots in Australia, and a ton in the United States. One good thing that I noticed is that people just didn't download the Chris White Show. A lot of people went back and downloaded some of our other shows, and for those of you that are out there that did that, I want to say that I'm sorry. But, you know, there is a lot of good information in a lot of those shows, and tonight we will have a repeat guest. We're going to have Adam Gorightly back on because there was a lot that we did not really, that I feel that we didn't really get to cover too much in that show. I believe that's episode 12, I think. So we're going to bring him back on, and we want to talk a lot about one of the things that is kind of his expertise, which is the Manson family, and I kind of wanted to talk about Montauk, too, a little bit with him. So we'll get him on.
I'm going
to
ask him about Man Bear Pig.
Yeah, ask him about that, man. Ask him about that. The thing that washed ashore.
Yeah. I called him Man Bear Pig. I was like,
what are you talking about?
Not Al Gore. Not Al Gore. Al
Gore's Man Bear Pig.
Man Bear Pig. Also the name of a local Nashville wrestler.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Maybe we should get him on the show. Yeah. Like, yeah, man.
I'm sure he'd have a lot to contribute. Probably less than me, and that's sad.
Well, you know, you contribute. You contribute a lot more than you think. And anyway, I don't think without further ado, we're going to bring him on, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal.
Whoop, whoop.
Okay, and we are back on Conspiranormal. What's up, Luke?
Still sitting here.
I know, man. Still sitting here. Been only about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
on the line, we have the crackpot historian himself, Mr. Adam Gorightly, rejoining us.
Welcome. Welcome.
How's everything going with you?
Great. Thanks for having me on again, guys.
It's good to have you back. How's anything synchronistic or coincidental happened since we've had you on last?
Oh, ooh, you broke up there, but synchronicities, let me think. Have there been any monumental synchronicities in my life? No, but I'm always have my head open and my eyes open for those. Nothing monumental here of late. It hasn't been that long. I guess about a month ago you had me on?
Yeah, it was October 1st, about a month and a half.
Yeah, nothing earth-shattering like everybody else. I'm waiting for December 21st, 2012, see what goes down on that monumental date. Some say the demise of the Twinkie is all tied into these end-time prophecies of the Mayans. There was actually a line from one of Nostradamus's quatrains about the how did it go? Something about the passing of the cream-filled pastry will signal the ending of an age, or something to that.
What?
Well, I definitely think we're in trouble then.
Uh oh.
Because if Nostradamus said it, it must be real. Any doppelgangers?
He was always right, yeah. Oh, you know, as a matter of fact, there was some weird doppelganger activity going on, at least according to Andy Colvin. You familiar with his work?
Yeah, I am.
Well, he's got this thing about, so do I, about doppelgangers. Who knows, we might have talked about this last time, but did we talk about my doppelganger out at the conspiracy conference? We already covered that territory?
No, we didn't. We should cover that before we go on.
Okay, this happened, it was Conspiracy Con 9, number 9, 2009. That's pretty easy to remember, and I'd been corresponding with Andy Colvin quite a bit, but we finally met up with that and met up at that event out in San Jose, actually Santa Clara, California. And for those who don't know, Andy is more famously known as the Mothman photographer, and he has some pretty interesting theories about Mothman kind of being his guardian angel and making him aware of a lot of different conspiracies going on in the world. So check out Andy's work. But while we were there, I got to the venue where the conference was going on. I was checking in at the hotel, and going to pick up Andy, somebody stopped me and said, "Hey, you gonna bring the books in?" I had no idea who this fellow was, and I said, well, I don't think I have any of your books. I brought some of my books to the event." He looked pretty confused, and then his wife walked up by him, and we're talking. I go, "Well, maybe it's my doppelganger you met." I was just kind of joking with him. He looked more complex, and his wife started chuckling. And I found out that this fellow, God, I'm going to forget his name. That now he was there as a one of the speakers of the event. It turned out he worked with surveillance devices and sold these devices to people who were trying to. You know, people that feel they're being mind controlled. These are the type of instruments that can block, like, microwave beams being beamed at you and whatnot. And this guy's name will come to me in a second. But so that was kind of a weird incident right there that I thought my doppelganger might be running around the event. There have been stories about an Adam Gorightly double dating back more than a decade or so. It was shared with me by a psychic by the name of Eugenia Macer Story back in, I think, the late 90s. She claimed she saw an Adam Gorightly double, somebody, I guess, pretending to be me, who looked like me at this East Coast New Age conference. So I actually ended up writing a piece called The Doppelgang for the recent issue of Paranoia Magazine. Seems like this has gone on at different UFO and conspiracy conferences, because I got an email from my friend Ken Thomas, editor of Steam Shovel Press, a couple years back. He had gotten a fan of his had sent a photo of Ken with this fan at a UFO conference around 2002 or 2003, but the odd thing was that it wasn't Ken in the photo. It was somebody pretending to be Ken who looked quite a bit like Ken, who had a nameplate on there that was Ken Thomas, but Ken looked back in his record and he wasn't at the this UFO conference, the one they have out at Laughlin. He wasn't out there this year, so I started seeing this trend about doppelgangers showing up at conspiracies and UFO events, and so I wrote this piece, The Doppelganger, and there was more incidents of that. There's been Andy Colvin claims his doppelganger has been running around different things. So anyway, we had this doppelganger experience back in whatever it was, 2009 with Andy. So he's always on lookout for my doppelganger. And just yesterday, this popped up on Facebook. Somebody apparently had took a photo of Mothman through a peephole. And Andy did some analysis of this, and as he zoomed it up, the face of Mothman looks a hell of a lot like me. There's a big mustache and the same glasses. So Andy's developed, of course, this whole theory about my doppelganger pretending to be Mothman. So yeah, there's your synchronicity you're asking for. That's kind of a weird one. It might be a bit of a confabulation on Andy's part, but
hey Adam, I think we got I think we got the NSA listening in again, because you are kind of cutting in and out a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds like you're coming from like four different places.
Oh.
So they, if they cut, just
well,
just
maybe they'll give you some more hits if you get the NSA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I do get weird hits from DC, so I don't know.
I've been prepared for a couple decades for them to take me away. Hee hee ha ha.
Yeah, it might happen. You never know. Do you want us to try to reconnect, possibly?
We're having the continued.
Yeah, I'm still getting it.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's try to reconnect.
Sometimes Skype is like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'm gonna hang up and then I'll reconnect. I'll put like some.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I'll put some silly music in or something.
Okay.
Okay. Hopefully, we found the bug. So.
Yeah, Skype is flaky like that sometimes. Sometimes it sounds like you're in the next room. Other times it starts wigging out.
Yeah, it's going on a little bit, but I think we'll try to get through the interview.
Yeah, it's still doing it pretty bad, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to get through what we can. I'm not going to worry about it.
Okay,
right now.
Sure.
If they cut last time, when you cut out on us, and then when we reconnected, it sounded okay. So, but I think they're just they're just trailing us.
On my end, you guys sound perfect. Okay. There's no breaking up. So who knows?
All right. Cool. Excellent. Okay. Cool. Well, everyone.
Let me replug in my headset here just to make sure everything's snug.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's give it a... Okay.
Okay. Does it sound better to you, Luke?
It sounds about the same, but let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, well... Since everybody got to be entertained with that, I wanted to talk tonight, Adam, about something that I know that you've been considered an expert of, and I know that you're not too much into it anymore, but kind of wanted to talk some about the Charles Manson stuff, because we didn't even get to touch that last time. And I guess the main question there for me is, you know, you have the kind of like the official story of Charles Manson and his family, you know, quote unquote official, the Vincent Bugliosi version, and you know that his idea of, you know, Helter Skelter and that being the cause of the murders and all that. How would what you've studied about Manson, how does that differ from kind of that official line?
Ooh, boy.
Quite a question.
Well, you know, how I got involved in it, this is dating back to the mid-90s. Even before that, I'd been kind of interested in the Manson story, really since the early 70s. I remember a bunch of friends got together over at the party house there on Weldon Street. We were known as the Weldon Street Crazies, and that must have been around 76 or so that the Helter Skelter TV movie came out, and that was we had got pizza and beer and just found it quite humorous in some parts. Steve Railsback did a great performance, you know, and of course not to minimalize all the murders and stuff, but I got interested in that point. That was like the mid-70s, you know, so that continued on over the years, and I read some of the books, and I got into researching, you know, conspiracy theories and whatnot, and started discovering all these conspiracy theories swirling around the Manson family. And I was, late 80s, I was writing for the zines of the period and looking into this. So I started gathering information to find out if there were anything to these various theories. Some were that the Manson family was some type of military mind control experiment, you know, and there were a lot of other rumors out there. So I started gathering material and thought someday if I got enough material, I'd write a book. And so I started down that path in the late 90s, looking at all these various theories. And at one point, I decided, you know, if I'm going to tell the story, I need to write about Manson's youth and how he gathered his family of followers and weave all this stuff together. And by the time I was done, I spent like 3 years writing this beast. It was 600 pages, a mighty tome. And some have called it the most comprehensive book on the Manson family. But to answer your question, you know, there's loads of different theories. And seems like Vincent Bugliosi, with creating the Helter Skelter theory, not to say that there's not some things, some bit of piece of truth or kernel of truth in his theory, but that he created this to cover up other things and basically use Manson as a scapegoat. Manson had these deep connections in the rock music scene of the era, and knew different people involved in the movie industry. So Ed Sanders, in his book, The Family, talked about a veil of silence that had been tossed over this segment of the Manson family story, and that, you know, in Helter Skelter, the whole theory, and Bugliosi's book, he was the prosecutor of the case as well, was the design of all that was used to cover up these different aspects of the story that we don't normally hear a lot. And, you know, until my book came out and some of the other ones that looked into some of these areas. It's interesting to note that Bugliosi, Mae Brussel, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work.
Yeah,
are you?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, she looked into the Manson family years ago. She was one of my early sources in the early 70s, and she claimed that Manson had been basically part of the COINTELPRO operation that was going on in the late 60s, early 70s to undermine the counterculture movement of the period. The FBI, the CIA was involved in this, and they had what they called agent provocateurs. They plant with the Black Panthers or in the Yippie movement and all these different various radical political groups. And some have surmised, Mae Brussel did, that Manson was just one such plant, you know. And she'd interviewed another guy named Preston Guillory, who worked for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office and during that period. And they were going out, and they knew about Manson, that he was set up there at Spahn Ranch, and that he was a parolee, and that there was some charges of statutory rape, and that he had guns and drugs out at Spahn Ranch. But the word to him during this period was hands off on Manson, that they were kind of watching and monitoring him, which once again indicates that he was being used. And that's Manson has made allusions to that as well over the years in some of his rambling, crazy-sounding interviews that he's alluded to, that they one of the things he said was he wanted to know who was pissing on his leash. This was after he got locked up. And what he means there is that if you put water on leather, it expands. So they basically let him out a certain amount, and then when they had used him, they pulled him back in. Now, Brussel also talked about people she called, I'm trying to remember the terminology, that were kind of vacuums that were part of the establishment, but they also got involved in researching the Kennedy assassination and RFK assassinations and various things, so they could glom on to a lot of the information and then basically put out the information fit for public consumption. And she thought Vincent Bugliosi was one of these guys, not only with the Manson story, but if you look into the history of different projects Bugliosi has been involved with, he was also involved in researching and being involved in the RFK assassination back in the day. And of course, in recent times, he's written a book on the JFK assassination, which was like the final word coming from the wise guru Vincent Bugliosi, that once again, Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone nut assassin. So he's one of those curious characters out there, these agents of disinformation, it seems, who are put in positions of power to cover things up.
That he was possibly trying to cover up some kind of, well, either the COINTELPRO connection with Manson, and possibly there could be an MK Ultra connection there too.
There could be that. Manson was in the right place at the right time to be a pawn in MK Ultra. He landed in the Haight-Ashbury in 67, and at that time, MK Ultra operatives like Louis Julian West, famous CIA MK Ultra dude, was ensconced in the Haight-Ashbury with some other folks. They actually had a safe house there where they would use prostitutes to pick up guys in bars, and they dose them with acid without telling them, and take them back to the safe house. But you know, LSD got basically unleashed during that period, and the folks who were distributing it really were the CIA. Had gone through a lot of hands. You know, they had sent up front organizations. That's how Kesey and Ginsburg and all those folks got it in, you know, Stanford and a couple years earlier. But, you know, at one time the CIA had bought up the world supply of LSD. And
right.
And so that was basically what initially got people like Kesey and those folks involved. Later, he had Kesey's associate, Osley, started brewing up his own acid. Now, the researcher John Judge claimed that the Manson family, and May Brussels claimed this too, had been handled by a naval intelligence operative that gave the Manson family the military version of acid, which wasn't the street acid. It was this particular military version of acid that was a derivative of psilocybin. I'm not sure where Judge got this information, and that the Manson family were basically used to undermine the 60s counterculture and screw it all up, and that was one of the tools the agencies used. You know, prior to the Summer of Love, with the influx of drugs, there was a real heavy radical political anti-war movement going on in the U.S. the early 60s. It was like on the Berkeley campus and real strong in California. And, you know, the inference here, I guess I'm making, is when they brought the drugs in, it kind of diffused everything and got people more into the Eastern mysticism and, you know, that type of stuff. So you know, other people took LSD, and I think used it for some positive means to enlighten themselves. But so there's that aspect of the story. And also, you know, writing about the Manson story and looking, I was connecting a lot of dots. And one of the sources was a book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, who tied in the Manson family to the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And also this guy by the name, they name him, use the name of Chris Jetz in the book, The Ultimate Evil, but that was just a pseudonym for this guy who was a mover and a shaker. He was involved with the CIA, he claimed, and was also involved with some of the big LSD manufacturers during that period. And Maury Terry had a source who put Manson and this somebody claimed he was with the CIA, this Chris Jetz guy. I know his real name, but I don't have it on my fingertips. But Maury Terry, author of The Ultimate Evil, said that Manson and this Chris Jetz had actually been associated with, and he put them together just a few weeks before the Manson family murder. So there's all these different dots out there I've connected in my book on the Manson family, and it's like any rabbit hole you go down into, you know, if you're looking for different things to connect the story into whatever, MK Ultra or this or that, you can find them. But it's, you know, it's indeed curious, some of these connections I found in the whole Manson family story.
It's almost like there's like a 6 degrees of Charles Manson in a lot of this stuff.
Oh, totally. He knew everybody if you start looking into it, like the 6 degrees, just a couple of degrees with some of the murders. It was Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski had dinner with... I forget all these names. The director of The Manchurian Candidate. Do you remember his name?
Frankenheimer, John Frankenheimer.
There you go, Frankenheimer. And Frankenheimer, basically, it was at John Frankenheimer's house that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski had dinner with RFK, the... night before his assassination. Actually, it was Frankenheimer who took RFK to the ambassador, where he was shot the next night by Sirhan Sirhan, who, according to Ed Sanders in his book, The Family, Sirhan Sirhan had connections with the Process Church of the Final Judgment.
I've never actually heard that before.
Yeah.
That's a new one.
Oh, yeah, and I get into... really pretty deeply into my book. And of course there's these alleged connections between Manson and the Process Church. You know, once again, as you look into this stuff, I've even found connections to Kerry Thornley and the Kennedy assassination that connect to him meeting up with the Process Church. I'm not saying there's anything sinister on Thornley's part, but you know, during the 60s it seemed like all these paths crossed, so it was an interesting era. And one thing I should note, there's a guy, Dave McGowan, who's done tons of work. Are you familiar with his series on Laurel Canyon and all the rock stars that came out of Laurel Canyon in the late 60s and all these connections that the rock stars had with the intelligence agencies? It seemed like a lot of their family members were involved in the military intelligence agencies, and it seemed to be the same thing for the Manson family, who knew a lot of these folks, the Neil Youngs and all those Frank Zappa, all those folks in Laurel Canyon, and you know, so there's all these weird connections there. I'd encourage you to go check out Dave McGowan's series on Laurel Canyon. It'll blow your mind. It's on the web. It's available. It's not a book. It's basically just a series he's put on the web. I think he put out a previous book on MK Ultra assassins, and that was more hassle to him than it was worth. He wanted to get the information out there, so he's put it on the web. Go check it out. I forget the exact title. It's something about the inside story of Laurel Canyon. It'll blow your mind.
One of the things in the Ultimate, I've never read the Ultimate Evil, but there is a book. I'm sure you're familiar with it, like the 50 greatest conspiracies, and they came out with the abridgment was like the 60 greatest conspiracies.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
it's kind of like my conspiracy Bible.
Yeah, it's a good one.
One of the things in the Ultimate Evil, I think Mari Terry, that's the author of that.
Yeah,
he even links Manson with, kind of indirectly and tangentially, but with the Son of Sam murders.
That ties into the Process Church of the Final Judgment, and that the Berkowitz was involved in a cult called the Children that was a spinoff of the Process Church. And they get into, in that book, The Ultimate Evil, that's another one that is worth picking up if you can find it. It'll blow your mind. But in that book, The Ultimate Evil, the author talks about this character named Manson II. That was kind of this Manson double guy that was an assassin for this Children cult and the Process Church of the Final Judgment, and goes back to the days during the period where many claimed that the Manson family interacted with the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And this guy, the Manson II, once again, there's all these names. His name will come to me in a minute. This fellow they were calling Manson II, his name was William something. I hate it when I can't remember these names, but this this character, William Manson II, was involved with Mama Cass. Mama Cass Elliott. He was one, a bunch of these kind of psychic vampires that were hanging around with her. And if you know the story about Manson, and Ed Sanders talks about this in his book, The Family, there was a lot of overlap there with the Manson family and the Mama Cass crowd. So, you know, everybody seems connected up, and there was a lot of unexplained deaths that came out of that Topanga Canyon, Laurel Canyon scene with all these different rock stars. Of course, Mama Cass had an untimely death in the early 70s. Another guy that the Manson family was tied in with, and he's kind of an unofficial Manson family member who later distanced himself from the family, was Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. Manson family was tight with Dennis, and yeah, in fact, the Beach Boys recorded one of Manson's songs. So,
Cease to Exist, which became what, Cease to Resist, I think, on the actual Beach Boys album.
The official title was Never Learn Not to Love.
There's someone that put it together, something on YouTube that they kind of pull from a different, like, Beach Boys documentaries and some other Manson documentaries. Uh-huh. It's really good, that shows kind of the connections that they had with the Beach Boys, especially Dennis Wilson, where Manson just lived in his house. You know, here's the Beach Boys, kind of like, you know, all the older people really love them, and they're you know, considered just kind of a part of quaint Americana, but they were hanging out with Charles Manson at one time.
They have a happy-go-lucky sound.
And there was the right, and there was the guy that was I can't remember his name now, but he was the record producer that was the son of Terry Melcher. Yeah,
right, son of Doris Day.
And that they think that Melcher actually, that what one of the theories in that video was, is that Manson actually was hoping to get Terry Melcher, but he didn't know that Sharon Tate had actually moved in.
Or he might have been sending a message to Melcher through them. Yeah, the Dennis Wilson connection, that's kind of an interesting story. Apparently that all came about because a couple of the Manson girls were hitchhiking, and Dennis Wilson picked them up, took them back to his place on Sunset Boulevard, and had sex with both of them, and later ended up catching the clap. But they So they found out where he lived and went to his place one time, and he wasn't there. And Manson took his girls, and they started partying, helping themselves to food and alcohol, and had the music cranking up. And the girls, you know, they were all dancing and taking their tops off and whatever. And Wilson came back from a all-night recording session early in the morning, saw this scene going out, and Manson came out and said, "Brother, come on in," kissed his feet, you know. And after that, Dennis Wilson was just enthralled by this crazy little guru who had all these this harem of women and had ready access to drugs as well. Manson ended up costing Wilson a lot of money. They crashed his vehicles and made themselves at home. They took his gold records and pawned them off for other stuff. And but the through Wilson, they met Terry Melcher, you mentioned, son of Doris Day. And depending on who you talk to, some people claim that he liked Manson's music, and it kind of promised him that he would get him in the studio and produce a record, and that he later welched on that. And so that pissed Manson off, and he was either you know, going to the house on where Sharon Tate and Polanski lived at, where Melcher had earlier lived at, that the Manson family went up there looking for Melcher when the murders went down, or another theory, they were just they were sending Melcher a message. Who knows?
And there's also, too, Bobby Boussoulet.
Mm-hmm.
And he had all sorts of connections with... he actually went to jail, I believe, before he killed somebody else.
Yeah.
And he actually went to jail before the actual Manson murders, I think. But he had some kind of connection with the Process Church, and I think with Anton LaVey too.
Ah, that's that's another one. He talked about the degrees of separation there. Yeah, I can talk about that. Beausoleil, he was a very, still is a talented musician. He was, just as a kid, he was in his teens, he went to L.A. and got involved in the music scene, and I guess he was in San Francisco, too. He got involved in an early version of the group Love with Arthur Lee. He was a guitar player for them, and so he was in the music scene, had his own bands, and at one point, the... independent filmmaker Kenneth Anger, who's also a Crowleyite and knew Anton LaVey and these people, he decided that Beausoleil would be the lead in his movie Lucifer Rising. He'd play the role of Lucifer. Now, this is a couple of years before Beausoleil got involved with Manson, and you can find these movies now. The actual title became Invocation for My Demon Brother, and also in that film is Anton LaVey.
Yeah, and Kenneth Anger. I think you can find those videos, I think, on YouTube now, I think.
Okay. And
okay, go ahead.
Oh, let's see where to go here. There's another Manson family connection, Susan Atkins.
Yeah.
She was a go-go dancer in the in San Francisco. This is, once again, this was around 67 or so before Atkins hooked up with Manson. Susan Atkins was one of the Manson family murderers. She was a go-go dancer in San Francisco there, and she ended up working for Anton LaVey. Anton LaVey had this kind of a spooky topless Sabbath review of kind of Satanism meets go-go dancing, and Susan Atkins was one of his dancers, so you have those connections as well with Bobby Beausoleil and Susan Atkins involved with Anton LaVey and Kenneth Anger and the whole kind of underground Church of Satan Crowley scene.
It's like real pleasant people.
Yeah. it's funny. I should note that Kenneth Anger's still around. In 2009, yeah. I came out with a new version, basically an updated version of the Manson book, Creation Books, came out with a new edition. So I did a little book tour. It was just a around California, basically. And so I was looking for venues to do some stuff at, book reading, signing, you know, basically. And one of the places we targeted was the Museum of Death, which is in Los Angeles. Pretty cool place. It's a museum about death. They got a lot of interesting stuff in there. And so, yeah, as they were talking to the owner about doing a book signing presentation, kind of finished up, and here in walks Kenneth Anger. Had some business with him. And no, actually, yeah, we showed up and Kenneth Anger was already there talking to the owner. So it was just kind of, now that's a pretty weird synchronicity.
Yeah, true.
On the way back, I have all these weird things I notice when you tap into the synchronistic world, you notice stuff. And I was with a couple friends, and we were coming back from L.A., and we stopped to get some gas, and I bought my friend a pack of smokes. And then I'm walking out, and I look at the receipt, and guess what it said?
Does it have, like, 666 on it or something?
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
I'm not making that up. Yeah. I have a scan of the receipt somewhere I put up on the web.
One thing about Kenneth Anger, too, was he did another film that was a dramatization of the Babylon Rising ritual that Jack Parsons did, which we kind of touched on Parsons last time, but that's another interesting connection.
Yeah, is that the inauguration of the Pleasure Dome? Or are you talking about?
It may just be the Babylon Rising. I mean, possibly
Lucifer Rising. Yeah, okay, I think you're right. Yeah, the it's interesting the history of the soundtrack for that movie as well. They if I remember the timeline here, basically Bobby Beausoleil ended up providing the soundtrack, and it's a pretty damn good soundtrack. Bobby Beausoleil has been, during his time in prison, he's been pretty active on different projects, and he also created a version that's a cross between a guitar and a synthesizer, it's easy to say, called the Sintar. But the history with the soundtrack for Lucifer Rising, Anger got to be friends with Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, this was during the period where Page owned Aleister Crowley's castle there by Loch Ness. And this was during the period where Anger, I guess, was editing Lucifer Rising. So he approached Jimmy Page about doing the soundtrack, and Jimmy Page did produce some sort of soundtrack. And that's kind of available, too. It might be on YouTube for all I know. So Anger was actually doing the editing of that movie in the basement of that place. Anger, like he does with most people, he can get angry. He had a falling out with Jimmy Page and said what Page produced for him was worthless. And this was in the mid to late 70s. So he approached Bobby Beausoleil to do a soundtrack. Beausoleil was in prison, Tracy Prison, but in prison, a hell of accomplishment. He produced the soundtrack for the film Lucifer Rising. This has been put out on CD as well. It's a pretty damn cool soundtrack. Beausoleil is a pretty talented composer, arranger, guitar player, you know. So it's just such an odd story, all the connections the Manson family have.
He probably could have done something really good if he hadn't killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Luke's got a story, something that like he knows about actually here in Tennessee, probably that you'd be interested in hearing.
Yeah.
So when I was going to high school, there was these rumors going around that Charles Manson used to hide out in a place called the Devil's Racetrack, and it was right down the street from our house, just a couple streets down. And it's this really big, wide mouth cave, you know, just like a cave you walk in, and it's like a dome, a big dome, you know, the cave entrance. But anyway, they call it the Devil's Racetrack, and apparently he hid out there when he was coming up through the south.
Mm-hmm.
And not far from there, from the Devil's Racetrack, is Hippie Hollow. And it's actually, now I looked it up on Google Earth, and it's called Bible Camp Road. But that is the location of Hippie Hollow. And it was a place that was kind of like off limits to everybody, so all of the kids in high school would get out and drinking and everything, and they would dare each other to go to Hippie Hollow, you know, because of there was rumors going around that you'd get shot at, or they'd try to run you off somehow.
Yeah, that was indeed, I mean, it's possible Manson could have been there. There is that period where rumor has it, legend has it, he went to the southeast, and there was like the unexplained murder, it's still unexplained, of a guy named Darwin Scott, who was the brother of Colonel Scott, the father of Manson, during that period. And I forget what the year was. It was must have been around 68 or so, maybe 69, somewhere in there.
Well, what I saw that added a little bit more validity to it was he apparently had some relatives in southern Kentucky, like right by the border, like up by Portland or something like that. And from the stuff I read, it said that he had some relatives, too, in North Tennessee, an aunt and uncle or something like that.
Yeah, Manson was from Kentucky, actually. I think he was born at Kentucky or West Virginia.
Okay, yeah, so that had to be a little earlier then.
But I think he lived in Kentucky for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, man. The guy got around.
You never know what you're going to run into here in Tennessee.
there's a lot of mysterious things. You start getting out into the country.
Yeah,
know.
Really.
And that's where James Shelby Downard spent a lot of his life, his final years.
Did he live here in Nashville?
He lived in Memphis.
Memphis, okay.
Yeah. And I have the address where he lived, and he lived there with his sister up until his death, and he died in the late 90s. I have some correspondence that has the address on there. And he knew about, he was always looking into underground tunnels and entrances and stuff, and I guess he'd done a lot of research into the Memphis area about different underground openings and tunnels in the city.
Yeah, he's kind of interesting too. I'm not too familiar with him, but I believe he was the one that came up with the idea about the Kennedy assassination being kind of like a Freemasonic ritual. Was that him?
Yeah. Let's, can we take a short break?
Yeah, that'd be great, actually.
Okay. Be right back.
All right, no problem.
We were talking about...
Yeah.
James Shelby. Mr. Downard.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it's something I haven't really covered a lot of, but I do. I think it was in that same book that I mentioned before. I remember reading about it.
Yeah, he has the King Kill 33 theory, which theorizes that the JFK assassination, a lot of other events, happened along the 33rd latitude and was part of a basically a Masonic ritual, and that Kennedy's assassination was the killing of the king to kind of bring about this thing that Downard called the revelation of the method, which is the beginning of this mass kind of programming and shattering the psyche of mankind to prepare them for the New World Order, I guess.
Yeah.
As a way to characterize the whole thing. But yeah, he lived in Memphis, Tennessee there, was a man of the South. Very interesting character. I write about him in my book, James Shelby Downard's Mystical War, which is really the only biography thus far of Downard. There's some autobiographical material, the book put out by Farrell House, and of course some of the stuff he wrote with Michael Anthony Hoffman, King Kill 33, and there's a couple other pieces out there you can find if you seek them out.
There's some other interesting things. I don't know if like our mutual friend Guy Malone, but one of the things that I've heard, this is not necessarily coming from him, but from some other people, is you have also on the 33rd degree parallel is the Roswell crash.
Yeah.
I believe. And there was a researcher named David Flynn. I believe he's deceased now, but he looked at where, you know, like the Book of Enoch and the Watchers and all that, where that they descended from to Earth was on Mount Hermon. In Israel, what's now Israel, and that actually that the others, the exact others, and that's also on the 33rd degree parallel, and on the other side of the other side of the Earth is actually Roswell. So that kind of made me think of that when we're talking about the 33rd degree.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that connection. I remember David Lynn. That's kind of how I hooked up with Guy Malone. He had us. Yeah. Myself and some other folks come out and speak at Roswell back in, when was that? That was like, it was on the anniversary, 2000, and boy, it's been a few years now, 2006, 2007. Yeah. And my take, a guy like me, I'm not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination, but I had done some work on how ritual magic seemed to be tied into the UFO experience, and it kind of paralleled, in a sense, the work Guy was doing in this David Flynn. I didn't realize he had died either. He was relatively young guy, David Flynn. That's
yeah, he passed away sometime last year. Yeah.
Mm. That the 33rd parallel, yeah, it if you track it, you know, it goes through Dallas, Texas, and there's a lot of 33 is the highest degree in Freemasonry, and there's all these three in the assassination. It happened near the Triple Underpass. There was these three tramps, three assassins in Daly Plaza. There was three shots. There's all kinds of threes. 1963, it happened. So there, you know, there's the Daly Plaza assassination there on the 33rd degree latitude. Then it goes through Roswell and Alamogordo, where they tested the first atomic bomb, and that was like the beginning of this alchemical working,
which was called Trinity.
There you go, the threes. Also, I believe it's Albert Pike founded Freemasonry, Scottish Rite Freemasonry in South Carolina, somewhere in South Carolina, on the 33rd degree. If you take it the other way, going west, it'll take you to Disneyland, where there's the Club 33. You laugh. And my friend Walter Bosley has done a lot of, he wrote a book called 33rd, what do you call it? Dealing with experiences he had in Disneyland as a young man. And he feels that it's like some sort of power node, that all these places are energy nodes. That's why these magical rituals are, that's why they take place on these different areas. And that's where the energy, or what, you know, there's ley lines, whatever, crossing in these particular areas. Bosley claims that he had some paranormal experiences on a carousel that's no longer in existence at Disneyland. There's some other ride there that was actually some type of time portal or some type of alternate reality device that could shift you into a different dimension or reality. So, yeah, you have all these weird stories about the 33rd latitude as well.
I don't know. I wouldn't doubt it. But all the mysterious deaths at Disneyland that you talked about as well.
Mm-hmm. This was a personal friend of yours?
Yeah, Walter Bosley.
What did he say he experienced?
Let me think about this a little bit. He has written a book called 33rd Latitude, I think, or Latitude 33, one of those. And he claims that he met a fellow there that he thinks was one of the original designers of Disneyland, who died years before this meeting, whenever it was, like in the late 70s or 80s, when Walter was a young man, and kind of shared with him some of the secrets of what was going on at Disneyland, that there was a reason when people go to the magical kingdom, there's this sense of wonderment and awe. Not only had to do with the surroundings that were created themselves, but an energy that comes out of that area. And I think what Walter's suggesting is that was a time portal, this one of the original designers of Disneyland used to come into the future to share this information with him.
I see.
This is true conspiranormal material right here. I just want to let you know. This is the
you should have Bosley on your show if he still wants to talk about this stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool. Well, I'll look him up.
Yeah.
One of the things
he goes through different phases where he's also a film director, producer, and sometimes he likes to get away from the high weirdness, but you can get him going sometimes. So yeah, it's worth checking out. I can give you contact information.
Okay, cool. One of the things I wanted to talk about too, Adam, was Montauk.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you in the Beast of, I really enjoyed your article on that. And there's some real, I mean, it's probably one of the strangest things for me, at Montauk and the Philadelphia Experiment. And I just, you know, kind of like, you know, what is your idea of what happened there? I mean, what do you think about Montauk and what it could have been?
Here we go again. I warned you when we were going to do this interview that actually that's a piece I wrote, and I think it's called The Montauk Mythos, and it's in the Beast of Adam Gilrightly. We'll do the little plug here that recently came out on Kindle. It's a book. The hard copy was published, it's been several years now, and we recently came out with the Kindle version. That was one of the areas I got into, was this whole Montauk mythos, and I think the piece I wrote about all this was it's a good 10 years old or so, probably older than that. So my memory, I've forgotten about half of everything I learned about some of this weird stuff, but it was just me kind of piecing together the whole Montauk mythos, how kind of evolved out of the Philadelphia experiment, which a lot of people know about. If they don't know about Montauk, they probably maybe seen the movie or read the book that came out in the 70s that was about this ship that was during World War II, this ship, the USS Eldridge. There was a secret project. They were trying to make it invisible, undetectable by radar. You know, think of Star Trek, a cloaking device. And I guess this was prior to World War II, or right as they were gearing up for World War II. They conducted this experiment to make this thing invisible, and unwittingly, as the story goes, they not only made it invisible, but they teleported the thing 100 miles away to North Fulk, Virginia. So it got teleported from Philadelphia to Virginia, where it reappeared. And then it was somehow they were able to transport it back again to Philadelphia. And during the course of all this, one of the crew members got planted into a wall or the bulkhead of the ship. So yeah. That's kind of the basic story of the Philadelphia experiment. There's probably a lot more to it. And so Montauk is kind of a spinoff of the whole Philadelphia experiment. And so... Maybe you can get me going. Share your thoughts on Montauk.
Montauk to me, it's such a—I mean, it's such a strange and convoluted subject. My personal thought on it is that it's probably more to do with mind control than with time travel or teleportation.
Yeah.
You know, it's, Al Bielek is the one that comes to mind. And just, you know, his idea of that he was another person named, what, I think Duncan Cameron or something like that. And he jumped with another guy, jumps off the Eldridge and ends up in Montauk in like 1983.
There you go. Yeah.
Which just so happens to be the plot of the Philadelphia Experiment movie that came out in 1984. But I have this feeling about Bielek and some of these other guys. I can't remember. There was these three guys.
Preston Nichols, Al Bielek, yeah. And Duncan Cameron.
Yeah. And they all had these ideas that they were all part of the Philadelphia experiment, that they had been different people, and that, plus they were part of the Montauk experiment and doing time travel experiments and things like that.
Yeah, I had a bunch of, where did I get them? I might have tossed the damn things because I thought they were so ludicrous, but I had a bunch of videotapes that had interviews with all three of them. Duncan Cameron's a strange cat, too, but kind of how Montauk enters into this is that they started Montauk, Long Island had this base set up where they were doing some weird projects and stuff, and somehow they went back in time. They had like a time tunnel, if you remember the TV show The Time Tunnel, where they could go back in time, and they went back to when the Philadelphia experiment happened and plucked these guys out and brought them to the future and got him involved in the Montauk experimentation. I do think it's about kind of a mind control thing, but they said they created this thing called the Montauk chair, and Duncan Cameron was the kind of the guy they used. He had some incredible mental powers, and that they could basically fuck with reality and create different alternate dimensions and different time tunnel realities and all this stuff. Now, that's kind of the cover story, but then other people say that who knows what's real, what's not real, but that there was some type of mind control going on with all this, and they had used Tesla technologies and the Nazi stuff from Project Paperclip and on. What I do know out of all of this came a bunch of people who emerged, you know, after these three guys shared their stories, that people started coming forward claiming they as well had been used in all these Montauk experiments, basically to alter the nature of reality or to do weather modification or on and on, teleportation. The gray aliens were mixed up in all of this, and there was a bunch of these guys called the Montauk Boys. And they were all these blonde-haired, blue-eyed guys that were, they claimed they had been used, sounds like the super soldier thing going on now, to be used to make this super Aryan race, and these guys had been programmed. And this Preston Nichols got involved with deprogramming these guys, and this is where it gets all very weird, that he was using some type of Reichian therapy, tantric therapy, to deprogram them, basically using kind of sex magic to deprogram a bunch of boys, teenage boys. So it sounds like you're getting some weird homo pedophilia mixed in.
Yeah, there's that was that, I had never heard of that before, that part of the story before, when I read your article there. That basically what he was doing was just basically jerking them off.
Where I first heard this was from my friend Alexandra Chica Bruce, and you can probably still find it on the YouTube. Who knows? I guess these videos are still around. In the late 90s, I first heard a lot of this Montauk stuff through. It's when streaming, some of the first streaming radio was going on. There was a guy named Richard Metzger who later had a lot to do with disinformation. That whole empire that they put out the books and stuff. He had a radio show called the Infinity Factory, and one of his guests was Chica, and she was talking about a lot of these things, and they. She ended up producing a segment of, they did a television series for like British television called Disinformation. Those videos are available too if you seek them out. And they talked about a lot of this stuff. And it's interesting, Alexandra, she was also a Montauk experiencer, and she wrote a book. I forget the exact title now. Experiments in Time, the Montauk Murders, or something to that effect. Dealing with a guy named Phil Schneider, and it kind of dovetailed with Dulce and all of that. But
I was about to bring up Phil Schneider, actually.
Okay, but she as well, she got involved into this Montauk scene. She lived out in New York. She's back in New York now. She started having memories and stuff, and she'd be at New Age conferences, and somebody pointed at her and said she was an MK Ultra victim, and she started having memories about Montauk and MK Ultra. So we had this whole subculture of people who came out of this scene that was a spin-off of kind of the Montauk, that maybe something weird was going on at the base. The episode they produced of Disinformation with Alexandra Chica Bruce and Richard Metzger went out, and they actually filmed the base there in Montauk, Long Island, what was left of it. Apparently, after the Montauk experiments finally ended, it was sabotaged, as the story goes, by these three guys, Balick, Preston Nichols, and Cameron. They basically sabotaged and destroyed the experiment, and that's when it all closed down. But the base itself is still out there.
Yeah. And there was something there. I think it's probably been blown completely out of proportion. But what makes me think about Al Bielek and the two other guys that, you know, either they're just crazy and they're just making up stories, or there's a possibility that they do believe everything that they're saying, and that somehow their brains have probably just become so fried by probably some kind of experimentation that they actually believe that they experienced all this stuff. Phil Schneider probably was another one that was like that too.
Well, that's another whole thing, the Phil Schneider story. I don't know if I'm even equipped to go there at this time, but that's kind of what he was talking about is a spinoff of the whole Dulce Underground base, the Dulce Wars, that whole thing. And people who are involved in the Dulce scene, I've talked to them, they tell me that Schneider really didn't show up until the mid-90s, you know, and supposedly the Dulce Wars happened in the late 70s, and the story emerged in the late 90s, and that Schneider was basically basing his story, quote-unquote story, on the whole Thomas Costello story of that Costello was actually the security guard at Dulce, and it kind of has a parallel, I guess, with Montauk. I never thought about that they tried to Dulce and some other renegades there that worked at the underground Dulce base, where they were doing all these alien human hybrid experiments, all this nasty stuff that Thomas Costello and his associates basically sabotaged that and started the Dulce War, where they were battling with reptilians and all this stuff, shooting laser guns, some stuff right out of Star Wars.
This is this true high weirdness.
It is.
Well, Adam, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, is there anything that you wanted to say? Or
Did you ever get to a chance to watch that documentary Searching for Montauk? It was on Discovery or TLC or something like that.
I have not. I don't believe I have. How recent is this?
Pretty recent, within the past couple years. I just remember I just remember one part from it, and they found a shaft going into the ground, kind of similar to a sewer, with the like metal stairs going down, and it was just just concreted in. Everything was concreted in.
There's definitely something there.
Two shafts, if I remember right, that were concreted in. And in a big, like, abandoned antenna.
Yeah,
I've seen the abandoned antenna. It seems I've looked into Dulce and Area 51 quite a bit, and the reoccurring rumor that seems to pop up that these were toxic dump sites for weapon storage areas, radiation type of things. And so you got these weird stories circulating around them that take attention maybe what was really going on there. And that might be one of the explanations, and that might explain why an area was they basically covered it up with cement or whatever to, who knows what that awful toxic waste might be down there.
Right, sure. Yeah, that is a good container for it, so that would be a definite possibility as well.
Adam, is there anything that you're working on now that's coming out in the future?
I'd rather just plug my latest book, Happy Trails to High Weirdness.
Okay.
And also the Beast of Adam Gorightly. We came out with the Kindle version through Fiji Press. Those are available through Amazon. And yeah, I'm working on several projects now, but it's I hate talking about them until they're actually out and available for the public. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
What do you make of Montauk's man bear pig?
What the hell is that?
That was a thing that washed up on shore like a few years ago.
Yeah, I remember that. There was some rational explanation for that eventually, as I recall. I forget. It seemed like something that this got all buggered up and had a mushed up face or whatever, but it seemed like there was some good explanation for some weird looking thing that washed up on the shoreline. I guess a lot of weird looking things probably wash up.
Yeah,
it was probably something from that chair that mm-hmm. sat in. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Came through the time portal.
I think mm-hmm. it could have been an elaborate hoax because it looked like a couple animals sewn together.
And oh, yeah.
All you see is just that one photograph, too. I only found one.
It's like these Bigfoot videos that come out, you know. It's like anything nowadays with all the Photoshop. Or there was this recent one of supposed Bigfoot video in Colorado or something. A couple people are out in the woods, you know, and it's the film technique from Blair Witch Project. They're talking, laughing, and oh, what's that?
Yeah.
And so you get a kind of a blurry image, then the blurry image kind of shifts towards them, and then you see the camera down and they're running. I think I would have, if I was in that position, I'd stand still long enough to try
stop
to get
and stare.
Yeah. Try to get the best shot.
See what the hell it is. If it's a bear, I tell you, unless you're in grizzly country, then yeah, grizzly will come out. In Colorado, they don't have grizzlies, so you might get a mama bear if you've been screwing around with her cubs. But I've seen a few bears in my life, and they usually bolt when they see humans. So I think I would, and of course, you know, until you're in that position, sometimes the hackles on your neck stand up and you bolt. But yeah, it's like all these videos are, it's the same crap. Show me something.
Yeah. Well, we're going to close out here, but stay on the line with us. And
okay.
And Luke, we're going to call it, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal. All right, and we are back on Conspiranormal. What's going on, Luke? What'd you think of that, man?
I'm just totally mind blown, man.
Me too. I am completely and totally exhausted after that interview. That was something else.
Yeah.
I mean, the Manson connections and then the Montauk stuff and all the connections. I think he even made a connection in the middle of the speaking to us this time. So. He's a great guest, man. You know, it's really glad to have had him on twice.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, you're a man of few words.
Well, I was going to mention something about Dr. Hutchison and his. I always talk about that whenever I'm talking about the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah.
Because according to the stuff I read, he made the machine in his apartment that was reproducing the effects of the Philadelphia experiment, like the same thing. It would melt the metal down, and it caused a fog and a mist around his apartment, and he saw things fusing together and stuff on his desk or whatever.
Right.
And apparently the Canadian scientists caught wind of it, or they were, or the government, the Canadian government caught wind of it, and they were snooping into, you know, breaking into his apartment when he wasn't there and looking around his lab and stuff like that. And then after several times of not finding anything, they broke in and took all of his inventions, and all he had was just the original blueprints and stuff on paper, just hidden from the...
He would be an interesting guy to get on this show.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe should work on that.
Yeah.
But we only got probably 2-3 more shows this year. So probably going to have those filled up. But next year, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good person to put on the list.
If he hasn't been assassinated already.
No, he's still around. he's not. I think he's way too high profile.
Yeah.
I mean, people know him
right there.
And like his Hutchison effect, I don't think he can successfully explain it enough. And it's been 30-something years, I think, since he did it. The footage of him lifting the bowling ball, all the little things.
Yeah, but I think he has been doing... I think this time around he's trying to keep it more undercover so he doesn't get exposed again. You know?
Possibly so.
Most scientists, that's what they do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, next week... next time, actually, in 2 weeks, we'll have on a guest named Scotty Roberts. We're going to be talking about... The Nephilim. He has a book that he wrote about that subject, and it's an interesting. I just finished reading it, just at the beginning of this week. It's an interesting take on it, because he kind of comes from kind of a theological viewpoint of it, but also kind of adds in kind of the ancient astronaut kind of idea. Which I think will be interesting in view of our last show before this one. So I think you'll find some of the things that he has to say very interesting.
Right on.
So without further ado, if there's anything you want to add, I think we're going to call it a night. Just everyone, hope you enjoyed the interview with Adam Gorightly. Possibly have him back on for some more high strangeness at some other point.
Some high weirdness, man.
All right. Well, let's call it a night, Luke.
All right.
Everybody join us back next time for
Conspiranormal. Yeah, bad crew. Going out tonight, gonna give me some play. All nice up with black and gray. OP's on my feet, my hat tip back so you can see the label. You can tell I'm gone, look at my eyes. This shit I'm on's got me unstable. Me and Adam with the... I don't even know up on the table. Stony Tony, what it is? Can you hear me pulling in? The subs blasting, peeling paint. Pack that bowl with stanky dank. He said, don't knock, just come on in. I got enough green for the week.
Yeah. All right. Peace.